Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse. It's January 29th, 2025. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator for AWS infrastructure that helps teams deploy their software faster. And we do this by leveraging our over 200 Terraform modules that have been battle tested and downloaded over 100 million times. So if you or your team has been banging your head against the wall with Terraform, just head over to cloudposse.com/meet. Again, cloudposse.com/meet. Answer a few quick questions, and we will show you what modern infrastructure looks like. So, how can you maximize today's session? Well, first off, our format's informal. You can engage as much as you'd like, ask questions, and if you're curious about any of our open source tools like Atmos or any of our Terraform modules, this is a great place to ask. And for those on the recording, we host these calls live, so don't miss out. You can join us by going to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, cloudposse.com/office hours. I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's session valuable, share it with your team. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse or send us a short testimonial about the value you're getting on YouTube or maybe in our Slack community. All right. Here is what I got on the agenda for today. First one was something that I just happened to come across long time ago. I dabbled with using Teammate for exactly this purpose, and someone has gone deep on implementing exactly this. I was only the 3,101th star to accomplish that or to discover it. So Teammate, if you're not familiar with, is a tool that's been around forever, at least 10 years. And you can run Teammate on your Linux terminal, for example, your Mac terminal. And when you start it up, you get a link. You can share that link with any of your friends, and now you can pair program together over a session. You don't have to set up lots of, expose your workstation publicly or so forth. It connects out to the Teammate service, which is totally free. So another interesting use case for this is, well, you can run Teammate in containers, or like in the past, I've used this to add Teammate to an ECS container, deploy these ECS containers so I could debug what the heck was going on inside of it. Now you don't need to do that anymore, obviously, since you can remote connect into ECS containers. GitHub Actions, you still can't do that. I think that it's been on the roadmap for GitHub Actions forever so that you can remote debug your steps or your jobs, rather, that are on a container on GitHub Actions, but it's still not available. So this is a way you can do that. Again, I haven't had a chance to try it. I only discovered it today, but there were some things that I thought were really neat about it. So first, it's just a simple action that you can add to a job. Now, keep in mind that all steps under job run on the same VM or under the same container for that duration. So that opens up some possibilities. One of them is that you can automatically then launch this container on failure when your job has failed, if you make this a step at the very end. And because you'll need time for you to connect to the job, you can set a timeout here. So the job doesn't end, killing everything that's there. So you have enough time to jump onto the machine and start debugging it. They also describe some other workflows that you can do. You can create like a dispatch workflow and add it to a step there while you iterate or work on something. So I'm right now dealing with some issues with testing with Atmos, and I just for the life of me couldn't figure it out. And I think I've figured it out now, and it has to do with differences in the home file system between Mac and Linux runners. But anyways, that's why I wanted something like this. Has anybody used this or tried something similar? Next one is something a lot of people have been talking
Oh,
about over the
sorry.
past week. Yeah,
Sorry,
go
I
ahead.
was trying to. I was muted and I was talking.
Oh.
I was just gonna say that two things to quickly point out about that solution are, in order for that to work, you need to allow your runners to have outbound access to the internet, which a lot of like in the enterprise, a lot of people don't do that, or they have like it goes through a proxy, or it's whitelisted what they're allowed to talk to or whatever. And then second is, you're the entire time you're running this, if you're running it on GitHub infrastructure, you're paying for the runners the whole time
The
that they're up
minutes,
while you're the minutes while you're debugging. So don't forget about that either.
yeah, good point. And Teammate is open source, and you can self-host it, by the way. So even in the enterprise context, if you can find someone to host a Teammate server, then you can get the same functionality. And oh, the thing I didn't mention is, so when this action runs, it's going to emit a message with the URL you click on to join that Teammate session, and you can debug. It'll also be an SSH endpoint that you could connect directly to. So you and it automatically can add your GitHub SSH pub key to the runner. So from your workstation, you can just SSH into the job and debug. So I think the power is pretty cool if you've been frustrated debugging things.
Yeah, I think really cool on that side. Opens up a whole bunch of questions from the enterprise security side of things when you're running this. So I think larger organizations, good luck getting people to approve letting you run this.
Exactly. So if you're an enterprise, they're probably not going to approve this action to be added. But this is incredibly convenient if you have like a GitHub action workflow that has full administrative privileges to AWS, and you kind of just want to, take over the entire organization. All you need to do is add this action in there, and you can SSH in there, and you can do whatever you want with full root credentials. And that's what Matt's talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, with great power comes great responsibility. All right. The other announcement was one that's been making its rounds. Everyone's really excited about this, that you can now be simultaneously logged into multiple different AWS accounts, up to five from a single browser. The five, my guess is this like five session limit is probably like the limit of an IAM policy or something, the number of characters that it takes to express this permission. But I'm just making stuff up.
It may be something that we discovered when we were doing this in Leap, is that after you had like more than five like Leap sessions, so what they ended up doing was they stored cookies under the AWS domain to do all of this. And then when you actually went to Amazon.com, the header length was too long for like the consumer site of Amazon.com to actually be able to accept those. So you could no longer browse and buy products from Amazon unless you deleted the cookies that Leap was adding to your to the Amazon the AWS.amazon.com domain name. So
That's interesting. That
so
sounds
it may be
plausible.
something like that.
Has anyone tried this out already? No. All right.
Just a
Okay,
little
I
bit. It works pretty
have.
well. It
Andy?
works.
Worked well for you?
But
But
same
I
here
will.
as well. Although the only complaint we have had is that most of our rules are IAM, everything is provisioned out of Terraform with massive prefixes in the role name. So at a glance, you can't tell easily which tab is associated with which account unless you know the account IDs off by heart. But still, at least you can still look at it.
Makes sense, yeah.
They don't use the account alias as the tab, as in the tab anywhere. They actually use the role that you've assumed.
It does use the account alias, but in our case, our account aliases have a lot of fluff at the beginning. All of them start with AWS, platform, team name, project name, so you can't really tell.
Gotcha.
I
Makes
guess that's
sense.
user error, eh?
I mean, we do something similar. It just happens that our aliases are a little bit shorter, but they can still get, long if you have a lot of OUs, for example.
Still, up until this day, we had to just use, the Firefox containers feature, so you could kind of sandbox and isolate each one. At least you don't have to do that anymore. So that's a nice change.
There are also a few plugins out there that let you do this, like Chrome. I know Chrome had some plugins to do it, so before that.
And since you said Firefox, have you tried Arc? It's pretty awesome.
Afraid not. No. Is it me? Is Arc isn't non-Apple friendly, right? Because I don't have an Apple device.
Oh, it works on Windows
Does
and
it?
Mac.
Yeah.
Yeah. Initially, they didn't have Windows support, but they've had it for, gosh, I mean, 6 months at least, maybe a year.
And I could be wrong, but didn't I hear something about the guys behind them, the browser company? Didn't they ditch Arc for something new recently?
I think they're going to live to regret that post. I think that's what the feeling was from the post, that they want to work on something bigger that has AI in it, but is still related to the browser. So they've built this browser that really is nice for power users and who have a lot of tabs and windows. But I think they're going to now start investing in this other product some more, which means that the attention to Arc the browser might go down because they're a small team.
Yeah, and in reading the announcement there, it basically said like I forget exactly what it was, but they want to work on something that has the scale of that's like planet scale, that has the scale of like billions of people. They want to create like the most friendly, like non-tech browser that everyone kind of uses, it that becomes the default browser for everyone, which is like taking the focus away from making a more developer power user friendly browser. And they said that they're going to work on that, yet they only have a only have whatever like a 15 or 20 person team, so obviously they're not going to be able to do both of those things, and they didn't say they were going to go raise a bunch of extra money and scale the team in order to do that, but they assure you that they won't abandon Arc.
Yeah.
Wink, 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 nod, nod. I don't know. Good luck. Good luck with that. There's a new shiny toy and for them to focus on. I don't, if they go down that route, I don't know what's going to happen with Arc. And meanwhile, there's a bunch of Arc issues that have been sitting around for a long time. One of which I'm really frustrated by, because if you go to the downloads tab and you have more than like a certain number of files in the downloads folder, it basically just like crawls to an absolute like halt. And I think it's 250 files or something they posted in on the issue, and they're basically like, well, this is by design. Not you shouldn't have more than 250 files in your downloads folder. Or something like that. I'm like, clearly you've never been a developer in Mac. I mean, I download 250 files a week probably there, which is, ridiculous. So yeah, anyway, I'm just off on a rant. I really like them, but I'm not that hopeful for what the future might be of the browser.
Somebody had posted a similar looking browser in the chat, but I don't remember what it was called. That's gotten some nice attention, but it's even a smaller team that is looking
There's
for browsers.
an open source version that's built on Firefox called Zen Browser.
How
Yeah,
is it?
has a couple rough edges, and I think it's mainly developed by one guy, but still a pretty cool project.
Yeah. Although it's 2025 and like Firefox still can't render like gradients properly and things like that. So there's a lot of reasons not to like Firefox too.
Chromium just like Chrome-based browsers update some of their security models though, so like uBlock Origin doesn't work on them anymore or something to that effect.
I saw something there and I haven't read the articles. I pinned them to read later. I've been behind.
Look at that. Yeah. So this view here looks identical. As you can see, I'm in Arc. You see the left-hand side here. It looks pretty much identical to the Zen browser. All right. Next announcement was one of the patterns emerging with a lot of these AI coding tools for coding is that they'll have a context file. Cursor has a convention, client, I believe, has a different convention, and now GitHub is introducing the same kind of thing. So you can create a file for repository, for custom instructions specific to a repository
where you, well, you can manually make that, you can generate it, but that it adds to the context that's given to the LLM when you ask it a question, so it knows kind of how it should respond, what different things are on the file system that otherwise, might not be obvious.
Yeah, I'm a heavy user of this concept, particularly in Cursor. I do it a lot. And one of the things that I find really useful for this is telling it like what technologies you're using, what your style is. You can give it some examples. You can give it some examples of like how you like to create like X, Y, or Z. So you could say like, my example function should look like this, or like if you're in React and you create components that you want them to all look the same way, you can say, my React components look like this, and you can give them like, if you do, as an example, if you do like arrow function based components, you can tell it that, you can give it a bunch of things and it will follow like your advice for the most part. What I have also discovered with this, I don't know if specifically this Copilot's that, but in Cursor, if you give it too much information, it actually tends to, or I've seen in certain Cursor versions, it seems to have gone back and forth that it affects performance. So sometimes it slows things down a little bit when you have a lot of instructions in there. I don't have a specific metrics on it, but just anecdotally, I had a very, very large instructions thing that I was generating and pasting it into certain projects. And I noticed a significant difference in how quickly Cursor was behaving. And when I reduced that, it started acting quick again. So I don't know if that was just a bug in a specific version or that's just like a side effect of this idea.
Yeah. I suppose it makes sense.
It doesn't really make sense because it should be like a one-time context update that basically says like, here's the context, and then it should be able to use that going for every question it asks on the model after that. But I don't know exactly how they implement it under the hood. I haven't looked.
Next announcement was something I know members of my team will celebrate, which is that the AWS Client VPN now supports multiple concurrent connections. So frequently we'll deploy like a VPN, AWS Client VPN in multiple accounts. Now you can be connected to multiple accounts concurrently. Or let's say they have to connect to, two different customers, both running client VPNs, they can do that now.
A quick question on the client VPN. Does that just use your own OpenVPN client, or do they have their own client that they
You can
force you to install?
technically use OpenVPN. They have kind of their own wrapper around OpenVPN that is the AWS Client VPN. I think there's some functionality also that you might not get if you use OpenVPN directly. Maybe it's MFA, I can't remember.
Okay, got it. Cool.
Yeah,
Thanks.
this is another one of those ones that I feel like I'm being Mr. Negative today, but like the reason you have like VPNs like this is basically so you can have secure communications between like an end device and a corporate network or whatever that has specific rules about who's allowed to access your devices and everything. And if you have two of these connections at the same time, there's a chance that the endpoint becomes a router and allows people from another network to traverse your connection and then access the other connection that you have access to, and or systems like systems from both sides could theoretically talk to each other if the routes were set up properly to do that. So you could get in some into some scenarios that I'm sure people don't intend to do. So it's also one of the reasons that a lot of enterprises, when you're running VPN clients, they're allowed split tunnel networking. Like they actually make you run all of your network traffic through the tunnel. They don't let you let your like internet browser hit from your local VPN connection, and then only selective traffic going over the VPN connection, because you can get into some trouble that way too. So it's helpful, but also another one of those ones that may introduce a security risk. So be very careful when you're doing that kind of thing.
I wonder if it's something that can be disabled, like a VPN server can say it doesn't allow concurrent
Well,
connections.
a VPN server can basically say it doesn't allow split tunnel connections. And then if you don't have a split tunnel connection, that then you can't run two VPN connections simultaneously, because all your traffic can only run
On VPN.
over one connection at a time, basically.
That makes sense. Okay.
With client VPN, do you get a IP on your AWS VPC subnet, or does it just not? Okay, cool.
Yeah, you dedicate like a range that is given out to the clients that connect over DHCP, basically. So when you connect, you get assigned a VP, not a VP, you get assigned an IP address, and then what happens is your local the VPN client basically injects routes into your local routing table to reach the routes that are published over the VPN connection. They set like a gateway basically to over the VPN connection. So you get a virtual tunnel, you get a VTUN interface like on your local device. So you actually get like an actual interface, and then they route traffic to that interface over the VPN essentially.
Cool. So EC2 hosts could literally talk back to your machine and vice versa directly. No NAT. Cool. Thanks.
Which is good, and but you can also see how that could become an issue if you're connected to two different networks, basically. Like they talk back to your network, and then your network can then have a route that also points to the other one, so they could reach one from one network and reach the other one through your machine as an in-between router, as long as the routes are there.
Yeah, totally. I see the security implications of it, but it also is kind of nice if you want that connectivity for debugging or something special.
Yep, for sure.
Next announcement was so one of the things that OpenTofu was teasing when the fork was just news and in the news and th like types of things they wanted to introduce, one of those things was the support for OCI registries. So if you publish modules or providers, you'll know that the registry protocol, while very simple, is still yet another protocol, is still yet another service that you need to host. I think one of the really awesome things that Helm did was they've done away with the whole registry concept, and it works entirely on OCI now and Git repositories. So you don't need to custom yet another protocol to implement to support pulling down charts. Well, the other thing is that OCI, basically, think Docker, is a very fast protocol to pull down. So this would be much faster than, for example, cloning from a Git repo. And ultimately, that's all. Well, like if you're using the official registry, that's ultimately all it's doing is a proxy or redirect to GitHub itself. With OCI, you can get really fast pulls for your modules in this case. So this is their RFC or their proposal, and then they have a survey here at the bottom they would like everyone to fill out before the I guess end of the week here.
Yeah, I think the only argument there would basically be that for a registry is that discoverability is a lot better if things are somehow registered in the registry, but that doesn't mean that that needs to be the way that you download them.
And I mean, I think most OCI implementations support some kind of a list operation. So I think, similar kind of functionality can happen. But yeah, like if you wanted a web interface for it, Agree. So you
Yeah.
can.
Well, and also I'm just saying, like, so how do I know that, Cloud Posse has this like OCI registry out there that has all these good things if there isn't a central point to go through and like
Yeah.
and search for and look for all of those things? And so like a registry of OCI registries would be good, or something along those lines, with a web interface like that you can search and look for and all those things. I mean, that's why the Terraform registry came to be in the beginning, and I think it was kind of a miss on their part to for at least for open source to have the actual download of things go through the registry. Like it should have just been a redirect to the GitHub places where everyone was hosting these things anyway. But it is what it is.
I feel like that's a little bit how Operator Hub worked. Like you can add your Helm chart registries to this, I believe, and then you can discover through. But yeah, there should be a web component like this that works across everything. What was the what it was called. Scalar launched a registry for Terraform that searched both well, that I don't believe was specialized to just one system.
Yeah, I don't. I remember hearing about it, but I don't remember what it was called.
And the last one was just something Michael shared in the Office Hours channel. If you're a Bitbucket user and you've been using the free plan, heads up, they're tightening the limits there that could affect you.
Yeah, I had comments on this one, and I actually got an email from Atlassian, because I use Bitbucket before they actually posted anything, so I couldn't find a link until a couple days later. But yeah, my take on this one is they're probably trying to reduce their costs and cleaning up some cruft that they have from years ago when they used to be the only provider in the game that was offering free private repositories. So it used to be that GitHub, you had to be a paid customer to get private repositories. Everything had to be public. So people would go to Bitbucket to do their private stuff. And then GitHub finally came around. They offered private repositories for free. So everybody kind of shifted to GitHub, but they didn't delete their stuff off of Bitbucket or like fully migrate everything. So my guess is Bitbucket or Atlassian, the provider, has been carrying around this cruft for years and years and years, and now they finally want to like take some action to kind of get rid of it. If you read into this, there's a statement where they say if you haven't accessed your repository in 3 months, it'll be archived. I think yeah, April, yeah, right around there, and you can use this self-service process for an admin to bring it back. So my guess, because they are hosted on AWS, is that they're going to take it from some sort of standard access or infrequently access, put it in Glacier where they can pay fractions of pennies for it, and then if you want it, you put in this request and they sort of rehydrate it back to your, whatever access you can get to that bucket or storage, wherever, wherever they actually put it. So yeah, I just think they're trying to cut some costs here.
It's funny. So don't use Bitbucket, but we use Jira, and we moved to Linear last year, and we just got an email saying that our free account's gonna—they're just gonna delete it if we don't start using Jira in the next 90 days or something.
Yeah, and I've gotten similar emails for Confluence workspaces that I was in. Yeah, they're just kind of, clean it. And I mean, I can't be mad at him for doing that. You don't want to be carrying around cruft that you don't have to carry around. But he's going to be a bummer for people who have some sort of one-off project that they kind of depend on being there, and then all of a sudden they can't push to it or pull from it or whatever the case is, because it's kind of frozen. The one caveat I will say, the last thing, is that they say 1 gig per workspace for file storage, but workspaces, you can create as many workspaces as you want on a Bitbucket free plan. So I don't know if they're saying 1 gig per account, per free account, or if they're saying per workspace. If it's per workspace, it's not that big of a deal, but if it is per account, then that's a much bigger deal.
Yeah, it might be the way they write it. It sounds like it's no big deal because it's per store,
Yeah.
1 gig. But when they say the word total here, I wonder if they're implying like
Yes.
across. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the caveat. There's not a good explanation for that part of it.
I mean, if you don't commit binaries, it's not that bad. But if you
Yeah, that's
commit
what I'm saying.
binaries, then it's a problem.
All right. That's all the announcements I had. Any other announcements that we should get to before Q&A?
I came across this tool. I'll post it in here that I guess has been around for a while, but I didn't know about it. I don't know if you've seen this, the region comparison.aws.com. You select two different regions and it basically gives you a diff of all the services in the regions, which is pretty cool. So if you pick like, that and some other, region and
Well,
then
yeah, the two that I'm, interact most with, and so
then
California versus Virginia, how similar are they?
yeah, so you wait a minute and then down below, you gotta scan for like orange color, like, but see all those, all like, I mean, this isn't like th this will give you like the actual like real diff, but there are some regions that like, especially like some of these newer, like I saw it as part of a the Mexico region that just got
I was just going
launched.
to select
Yeah,
that.
so if you select that and you can see there's a ton of services like that, all those things that have those
X,
X's
X, X,
and
X, X.
things like that, those aren't supported in the Mexico region or whatever. So the X means only available in the source region, and then there's something else that means only in the destination region, and then like the carrots there or whatever mean like partially supported or something like that. So yeah, but like this is a really cool, like if you're like, oh, I want to use this region, is this stuff available? This is the fastest way that I can now see if this is available. And it's on AWS.com, so this must be official, even though
Oh, yeah, AWS.com. I didn't see that.
yeah, so yeah, I don't know. I
I was
just
going to
came
say, this
across
is
it,
the
thought it
kind
was
of thing
cool.
AWS should have.
Apparently they do, except it looks different than like almost all the other stuff that they do, but yeah.
Exactly.
It looks like a project, like an intern threw together over the summer or something, and then they
Yeah.
productized it, but they just said, yeah, ship it. They didn't like
Yeah.
make it look anything like the console or any other AWS site.
It actually looks pretty usable. I heard at AWS some of the reps were using EC2 instances.info. I'm sure you folks have come across that site. It's pricing, and apparently it's more usable than obviously using the AWS pricing website itself.
Yeah, this is definitely the best.
So I feel like to your comment, Michael, if they had productized it, it wouldn't be as popular.
Just insane the number of instance types they have now. I remember when you could rattle them all off. Well, Q&A. This is the time during office hours where we ask Venkat if he has any questions for us.
Well, recently Bitbucket announcement around the free plan. We have some public GitHub repos where basically we're just publishing a lot of images, like on every commit or every tag, and we end up having a lot of them in some repos. I was curious to know if you've come across anything on your end, Eric, or anyone on this call, on just analyzing your usage of storage and stuff, especially on those public repos. And ideally, it'll never happen anytime soon, but if GitHub were to change your pricing, what's that impact look like for you folks? If you guys have ever thought about that, I guess.
One of the things I want to do is actually publish all of our modules and all of our components as packages, so they're accessible as containers basically, but they're all open source, and I don't believe we will be subject to any charges for that. Again, just another message for you to make your product open source.
Yeah, we are publishing publicly. My concern is if there's a change on the free tier or
Yeah.
like image stuff like that. Now it's like, all right, now like we would likely have to pay for it in the short term, but yeah, it would not be ideal. I imagine it's the same situation for you folks. If there is a change on.
Would be a big problem, of course, if we start doing that and then there's a rug pull. I don't think there's been many rug pulls with GitHub, but.
Yeah, the only one that we ran into on that was artifact storage. Remember, we were storing like test
For private
results.
repos. Yeah, we were doing
Yeah.
that. Those were private repos. And then we ended up spending hundreds of dollars a month on stupid plan file storage. But for public repos, the retention is relatively low, but at least for artifact storage. But packages, I'm curious what, I don't know, I haven't seen any mention that there's retention limits on packages.
Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, my
Michael.
concern, yeah, my concern would be like usage of a package, if there would be any sort of changes there. And I think back to Docker Hub, where they they became wildly popular. Everybody sort of used that as the de facto source for packages. So now everybody across industry, individual developers, whoever, they're pulling from Docker Hub. So they're shelling out all this cash on network egress and everything. And as people, they changed it so what you have to be logged in to get unlimited pulls without restriction or other cases. And so people are like, well, I'll just put my image on GitHub, And GitHub does a pretty good job about limiting the amount of package storage you have. But what if they get wildly popular now and they become the de facto Docker storage or something, and then they limit the logged in or anonymous pull, from their storage? That would
I
be my
think,
biggest concern.
it would be if it wasn't owned by Microsoft or that they
Yeah.
aren't already. I was just thinking about this again the other day. Just like, I just wonder how much they are donating, so to say, compute and storage for open source and public projects. It's like public infrastructure at this point, their importance to the ecosystem.
Yeah, I think the one thing that's important to realize for like around bandwidth for these type companies is that they're already like ISPs. So like Microsoft is an ISP, so they don't pay like they don't pay like whatever like AT&T or CenturyLink or like any of these people like to give them transit. They basically are in peering points all around the world with them where they have carrier exchanges. That's literally how like AT&T and like Verizon in buildings all around the world, there's the edge of a Verizon network and the edge of an AT&T network, and they literally have like fiber cables where one they plug into each other and they exchange traffic that are bound for each other's networks. That's like how the internet is kind of built everywhere. And very large content providers and cloud providers, et cetera, are part of that. So as long as the balance of like traffic doesn't go completely out of whack, for those types of things, like most networks will just freely peer with them because like in as many spots as they want, because that actually alleviates their backbone traffic so that they don't have to carry it to somewhere else to then hand it off to some, to some link. So, as long as you have enough scale, they'll pair with you in all these locations. So, I don't think bandwidth will ever be an issue for them, as that was my long
In
way of
contrast
explaining
that to
that.
Mirantis, who bought Docker Hub, they don't have any of that. So
Yeah, they're
they're
just.
paying Amazon to serve that Docker image
Yeah,
for them.
exactly.
So,
excellent point. Yeah.
yeah. All right. Next question, Venkat.
I've got
Put him on the
nothing on
spot. All right. Open mic now.
I've got one. Did you ever find out what was the deal with native testing, Eric?
Oh,
And why you
little
weren't using
bit.
it.
I think we talked a little bit more after your post on that. And I think we identified what was the rub for us. And it was okay. Well, so first of all, like if there were any differences between the two, don't know about that. I think that was something that Matt might have pointed out, but he was out then that day, so we can talk about that. But the other one was the ability for Terraform native testing to bring up your fixtures, your other dependencies. And that would kind of mess with what we're trying to do with Atmos, because Atmos is supposed to bring those up. So long as we don't leverage those fixtures for the tests in Terraform native testing, then I think it could work pretty well. It does support the var files, which Atmos uses and passes the config, so that would work. But Matt, do you remember what
Well, there's a few things around that one. So one, with the using those frameworks, I think we would have to not use Atmos to actually do the testing at all, because that means like we can use it and package it up and create a var file and pass it to that. But the Terraform and OpenTofu native testing actually controls the plan and apply lifecycle, where so you're not calling Atmos Terraform plan anymore. You're literally calling the native Terraform plan. So all the stuff we did about backend generation and packaging the var files and the creating context, or not context, provider TF dynamically and all that kind of stuff would have to be done as a pre-processing step, and then feed those files to that directory and then run the test. So it's just not. It's not that it wouldn't work. It's just that we'd have to do some work to make that happen. So that was one. And then second, I think the problem we had was that we were looking at trying to create a single test infrastructure that would work with both OpenTofu and Terraform. And on the Terraform side, we're limited to Terraform 1.5.7 because of all the licensing nunniness, and the test framework that we would want to use wasn't released until Terraform 1.7. So now we would have two sets of tests that we would have to maintain in order to be able to use native testing for both of those platforms
You mean
to
testing
make it
in
work.
1.5? No, or because Matt Gowey was saying that the testing interface was compatible both because they're doing it. They're
Not with
modular.
1.5.7 though.
But
It's
okay, but
literally.
no, yeah. So let me to repeat back to you what Matt, you're saying is like, hey, you folks don't want to touch Terraform above 1.5.7. And if you're running that even in your own GitHub Actions, you're concerned about it. So you would try and stick on 1.5.7, and therefore you would get into a situation of, hey, the testing utility in 1.5.7 is kind of shit, and what Tofu is allowing you to do in later versions and you actually can run without legal ambiguity is solid. Is that right?
Exactly. And
That makes sense.
even in the, they like in I think it was in 1.5, they released the initial test stuff, which was just the putting a toe in the water. And then I think it's in 1.6 or 1.7, they actually released the full framework. So the actual testing interface that looks like the one that's in Tofu doesn't even exist in 1.5.7. So that's the
Yeah, no,
problem
totally
there.
understand now. That makes a lot of sense. And I mean, we're running it for open source, like 1.9, right? We just, I bumped the Terraform required version because I started using template string in one of our open source modules, and that's only available in 1.9 when it's available in 1.7 of OpenTofu. And I hadn't really thought about, hey, is there like legal, because it's just an open source GitHub Action, I was thinking like, oh, it's not,
No,
there
you're
isn't an
safe, I
issue of
think.
running Terraform.
I mean, I'm not a lawyer and can't say that, but the main thing, yeah, if you read their FAQ, if you sell services on a product that is open source and they believe the product that's open source competes against Terraform Cloud, then you're in the violation.
So since you
Which
support
Atmos
your
could.
open, so since we support it and charge people for support, in theory, they could deem that as, as in violation of the license agreement.
Not the
Totally.
module itself, but some of the other things we do.
No, that makes more sense now. And that's just a damn shame.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, because it is a nice, like I'm really enjoying the native testing that we're doing. So yeah, I
Well,
don't
let's
know.
say
Bummer.
supporting Terraform 1.5x, is only tenable, what, let's say another 12 months max. I mean, there is a shelf life for it, where it's like saying that we only support Terraform 0.11 or something, right? It's useless in today's environment. So I think at some point that we're gonna have to revisit this and get some, clarity on what we want to do. I think so long as we aren't, competing, so long as there's, it's just testing open source itself, then I think it's okay. But we want to prioritize open tofu, like philosophically.
So
And it's
it's a
interesting to think about. Just one quick
yeah,
question.
go
Are you
on.
folks, it sounds like you're using Atmos as a new test harness for either
Kind of.
components or existing child modules?
Do you want to? I just dropped you a link, Eric.
Well, you know, when they
I was
or
actually going to talk about this. It's funny because we just finished this like in the last day.
So exactly. Thanks for bringing this up, because this was
I've been
something.
seeing Igor get after it with the tests on the components, so it's, I imagine.
Yeah, he's been putting in 60, 70 hours a week on testing. So
Jeez.
a lot. So
Props to
yeah,
him.
so why don't we just take a quick step back to give context? And that is that, Cloud Posse, we have this Cloud Posse Terraform components organization. Components for us are root modules. These are the top level most modules that you deploy. We've had these for years and years, but they were historically in a monorepo and historically didn't have any testing done on them. They used our upstream child modules, which were very tested. So what we are going through is a large effort to kind of mature our component ecosystem and introduce testing. But full stack testing, so that you can bring up a complete environment, more or less, with all of its different pieces, individually managed components, and test that that's working. So it turned out to be a learning experience for everyone, and I think we've gone through five or six iterations, like major like rewrites of how to do it. And I think just this past week we've settled on what we believe to be the final kind of implementation of that. It is built on TerraTest, and
Sort of, yeah.
yeah,
We
TerraTest and our helpers, and then it uses Atmos under the hood. We basically created our own Go test helpers to run Atmos, and then we can use the Go test ecosystem to do all of that. I still think that we want to support native Terraform testing, but due to the aforementioned things there, I think that it's something we're going to push off. And here's the deal: it's not mutually exclusive. I think if we added support for native testing, we would just do it in the framework that we've developed here. So yes, you can just write native Terraform test in HCL, but we would orchestrate the testing probably with the helpers and things that we've done. So I don't see it as unnecessary work. It's just help giving us the best of both worlds. So that
Can
said,
you show an
Matt.
example of what this,
Yeah,
of
was
what
it
the
this one? Was
new
it this
testing
one,
helper looks like?
Matt?
That one, I mean, you could look at that one. I also sent you another link, but that one's fine too. If you go, it's a different branch though.
Okay.
Oh no, that's the
I clicked on
branch.
your pull request, add test this one.
Yeah, that's fine. And then just go look at the Go, the Go test. Just open up
Yeah.
that. But don't.
So look here on the left side, though, first of all, just kind of. So what we've added then to the component. So we have a test folder, we have fixtures, and then we have the stack configuration. So we're testing this component in all in these different scenarios described here.
Yeah, can you browse the branch instead of this pull request though? Because this isn't
Okay.
showing the whole So just click
Yeah.
on the add test helpers right there, the link. Yeah. And then just go to test and then fixtures. And then just to show here what we have, and then look at the catalog, which is in Stacks catalog use case. So then right here we're creating like Atmos config for all the different variations of this VPC component. So it's disabled, it's a private VPC, it's a public VPC, VPC with flow logs, and VPC with IPAM, like all of those things. And then essentially we just run, if you go to the VPC, the go file that's a little bit further down, that one, VPC component test.go right there. So then we have this very lightweight helper where if you go to the top, you just define a test suite, and then you embed our test suite interface. Then you write your tests against that, which are basically just calling helper methods of like deploy and destroy. And then the one thing this isn't showing right now, but is that there's also a method you can call in there to just add dependencies. So you can say before you run these tests, bring up these five dependencies, and you can tell it bring up other stacks in your Atmos config. And basically it copies all this stuff to a test or to a temp directory. It brings up all of your dependencies once, then runs all of these tests with the dependencies in place, and then at the end tears everything down and destroys the temp directory. And it handles all the wackiness of state and setting environment variables and like everything you would need to do to make that all work in there. So just by running these small things.
So this
Wait.
is the thing we wrote that does that, the test helpers library. But yeah,
Impressive, guys. That's
it's
that's very cool.
for Go code, it's
A lot of
pretty
work.
it reads almost like pseudocode, but it's not HCL, right? HCL is definitely even easier to, grok probably as a non-programmer, but I think this gets us the best of both, where we can do still some of the more advanced checks that we want to check for functionality. That would be hard to just do with data sources and assertions that you can do in testing, Terraform testing. Yeah. All right.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Zach.
Yeah. So with OpenTofu, they recently, I think it's pretty recent that they are adding the feature for provider iteration. Did anyone else get like a collective shudder of fear at
Yeah.
that, or was that just me?
No, we've talked about it at length here. Yeah.
Okay.
We've been big opponents of using that. I think, if I were to break it down on the two sides, it's one that Matt Calhoun's point has been, I think it's a valid one, which is the language shouldn't say what you can or cannot do. It should just work consistently. And for loops on providers is it working consistently? Now, should you use it? Well, that's more a philosophical argument. And no, you shouldn't use it. And it breaks the whole reason you probably operate. One of the most common reasons to use multiple providers is to operate in multiple regions. And the whole reason to operate in multiple regions is so that you have DR, usually. And if you are coupling that tightly in your code, now you can't easily deploy when a region is down. Now, if you're doing it for other reasons and you really don't care about that, then I guess you can have at it. But our position has always been a Terraform component should use no more than two providers. And the only reason to have two providers at all is so that you can do automation for like joining two connections in a hub and spoke model. But unless you're doing that, then you shouldn't have more than one provider.
Yeah, or something like you have to connect to the root organization to delegate your security account as the administrator for Security Hub or something like that. You need one provider for the root account and one provider for the account you're operating on.
Yeah. Yeah, your
Thank
head's
you.
in the right place, according to us. All All right, well, we're at time. Zach, I'll get you some feedback on that article, and we'll talk about it on next week's office hours. Zach's done an exploration of one of our tools called Atmos and written something up, so I'm really excited to see the critique and